12-12. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Who says the arts don't matter? Broadway saved the $10 bill today. I know Kim was talking earlier in the day about the fact that Alexander Hamilton's face will stay on the $10 bill, and instead Harry Tubman will be placed on the $20 bill.
Yeah, Harry, she got a bump up on a bigger bill.
She got a bump up. I think Jackson was a bit more of a rascal than Alexander Hamilton, so if anyone was going to be replaced, maybe he is the person. Terry Savage joins us, as she does most Wednesday afternoons. And well, Terry, this is just breaking news, and I knew you'd want to talk about it. How are you this afternoon?
Well, I'm fine. First of all, just don't let me in, however, with beer and pot. You have to talk about champagne and caviar.
That was Bill Leck. It was not me. No, I'm really happy about this because I really, you know, Kim Gordon knows in the newsroom, I cannot wait to see the show Hamilton when it comes to Chicago. And, you know, I think he's an underrated founding father. I know that sounds crazy.
Well, he really was an important founding father. I mean, he really created the banking system in America. And it's a shame that we only have one piece of currency on which we could put a woman, because I'm also a Susan B. Anthony fan as well as a Harriet Tubman fan. They were both women who did, you know, amazing things, especially in their time.
So,
Andrew Jackson, I suppose if you go back in history, and I was an American studies major, that Andrew Jackson would be like a cross between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in his time when he became president.
Well,
he was the frontiersman.
So. Yeah, right. That's true, though. But he was the real populist, wasn't he? They, you know, divided him into
the real populist.
So that's the news going to come a little bit later today. Also, they say they're going to redesign the $5 bill to depict civil rights era leaders. So I would imagine that'll be a smaller picture. I know they're not going to get rid of Lincoln on the $5 bill, but some civil rights changes coming there. I really, I like that. So there you go. All right, you're on the phone, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the stock market, but I think next week is Smart Money Week, or Money Smart Week in Chicago, right?
Absolutely, and it's a very big deal.
Now, how did this get started? Are you behind this? Is this your baby?
Believe me, this initially, a long time ago in 2002, was my baby, along with Nancy Goodman of the Federal Reserve Bank. We were having lunch at the Fed one day, came up with the idea of having not a week, but a day. And we called the Chicago Public Library, and we got approval to do the Money Smart Day in the public libraries, and that has grown over the last, over something about 15 years now, to Money Smart Week, which now is sponsored by the Federal Reserve Banks around the country. And guess what? Big news. I never get a chance. You know, I travel all over the country speaking, and I never get a chance to speak in Chicago out in public just for business groups. But on Monday, I will be at the Harold Washington Public Library at noon this coming Monday, speaking for Money Smart Week, something I've done every year for the last 10 or 15 years, sponsored by the Financial Planners Association of Illinois. There will be 18 financial planners there. We'll introduce them, and you can each have a 15-minute interview with a real professional, one of the best financial planners in the city and suburbs, and meet with them and get a start on your own financial plan. And I'll be talking about the economy, the markets, and answering questions from the state. So it's free to the public. Harold Washington Public Library, noon on Monday. That's on my website. Come early because there's always a, you know, rush for seats.
There's also information at moneysmartweek.org. I know you can find info there. All right, so what any of those financial planners have predicted that the Dow would tank at the beginning of the year and have completely recovered by this time of the year?
Which is why I've never been a market trader, because honestly, I'd be thrilled to give credit to someone who at the end of the year said, you know, fasten your seatbelts, the first few weeks are going to be rough. We'll lose 15% or so in the market. But we'll be back to ahead by early April, by right after tax day. So I just don't think that was in the cards for anyone. It's why I just ask you to divide yourself. If you're young and you've got 20, 25 years till retirement, plus another 15 or 20 in retirement, you keep putting that money away regularly. If you're a few years away from retirement or actually in retirement, you do need stocks for growth to offset inflation, but you need to take opportunities to balance things out when you have gains.
You know, we were talking about that last week, about how millennials actually are saving well, as considering a percentage of income, but they're not investing. They're saving well because they were worried of the the 2008 episode. They came of age then, but they're not investing because they came of age then as well. So I think of the money people are trying to sort of woo them back into the markets.
You know, it's always scary when you're young, and this is the first money you're able to put aside. But what you don't realize when you're young is that time is so much more valuable than money. That if you even took a portion of that money on a regular basis and put it away, time would work its magic. It's always easy to be scared out of investing. I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong in the world, from the Zika virus to, you know, North Korea to, goodness knows, a terrorist. Yeah. There's plenty of things to scare you. But the fact is, if something horrendous happens, money will be the least of your problems. If, in fact, we make it through just like America has for the last 50 years since, you know, World War II, 60 years, really, 70 years maybe, then time becomes a valuable asset, leveraging your money. So you just want to prepare for the worst, but invest for the best.
Start now. Terry Savage, Words to Live By. So we'll see you next Monday at the Harold Washington Library and in the studio next Wednesday afternoon.
Absolutely. And please come. I look forward to seeing all of you at the Harold Washington Public Library next Monday at noon, but come a little early. It's not a huge auditorium. And you'll get to meet the Financial Planning Association of Illinois and have a real good conversation.
Just like Bernie Sanders, she's going to pack the place, so you better get there and get a seat. That's what she's saying. All right, we'll talk to you again soon, Terry. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It is a mild spring afternoon, so it's afternoon somewhere. Wait, it's afternoon here. Let's have a beer.
Oh, I can join you in that.
There it is. Jim Cook, the founder and CEO of Sam Adams Beer, is pouring himself a cold one. Is it cold? How about that?
And delicious.
What is it? 32 years ago, Jim Cook set out to... Well, you just set out to start your own little brewery, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to make good beer here in America, and I hope somebody would drink it.
It kind of ended up changing the world, or at least the U.S. world, the beer world.
Yeah, my little world.
Do you claim some paternity for all of that?
Well, I wasn't the only pioneer in craft brewing. There were several others. But in a way, you know, what a handful of us started in the early, mid-'80s in beer,
right?
And there wasn't even the term craft beer back then. There were just a handful of really passionate people about beer who started making great beer here in the United States. And I named my beer Sam Adams because I wanted Sam Adams the beer to start a beer revolution the way Sam Adams the patriot and founding father had started a political revolution.
Yeah, you did it.
And it happened.
Yeah. You must know John Hall from Goose Island.
Oh, sure.
Old friend here. So
yeah.
He was doing it as well. And they've had
he started it like 4 years after I did here in Chicago and built kind of a nice little empire.
Sure,
and then sold it to Anheuser-Busch, and the rest is history.
And so here you are, having mastered the world of brewing, and now you're a writer. Quench Your Thirst, Business Lessons Learned Over
Quench
a Beer or Two.
Quench Your Own Thirst.
Quench Your Own Thirst, and that's the important part of it, isn't it, right? Because
yes.
The theme is kind of passion.
Yes, and one of the messages in Quench Your Own Thirst is to think differently about risk. I wrote the book for a lot of people who were kind of in the situation I was when I started Sam Adams. I had a good job, safe, secure job, you know, cushy office,
right,
all that stuff. But it wasn't what I really wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I when I realized that, I went the next day and gave my notice. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And everybody told me, well, that's really risky, leaving all this security. And I said, it's not really that risky. I'm going to do what I love. I'm going to brew beer. And if it fails, it fails.
Right.
You know, we'll have a great party at the end when we go broke, and I'll pick myself up, and I'm not going to be homeless. But the real risk is not doing that, staying in something that isn't what I want to do, it's not really what satisfies me, and doing that for 30 more years and getting to the end of my career and go, oh, my God, I wasted my life.
That's what they say,
that's
right?
That's the risk.
The regrets are about decisions or things you didn't do rather than things
yes.
that you did do. I like this, though, because in the book you talk about passion and needing it, but there has to be a mindful passion to it, because you have to be good at what your passion is to succeed, and you got to know whether or not you're good.
Yes, I talk about...
How do you know?
Well, it's a very simple question, and Quench Your Own Thirst is a very unconventional business book, because it's really stories, each of which has a business lesson. Yeah. It's kind of bite-sized stories. They're from one page to six pages. And, you know, I don't have, like, one, you know, big idea like a lot of business books have. Like, oh, you know, you have to focus on this, or never have lunch alone, or, you know, give everybody your business card. This is really what I learned in 32 years of building Sam Adams. And one of the lessons is, if you're going to start a business, people buy the product. They don't buy the marketing. They don't buy the advertising. They buy the product. And your product either has to be better than the alternatives or cheaper than the alternatives. And you got to be brutally honest. And when I started Sam Adams, I couldn't be cheaper than the big brewers, but I could be better. I could make the best beer in America, give it to people fresh, and I knew somebody would drink it.
And one of the other lessons or things you write about is this saying of hire slowly, fire fast.
Yes.
Okay, I get the hire slowly part, right? Be sure, find the fit, see how they work with the team and all of that. I'm a little scared about the fire fast. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, that's very interesting that you would raise it, because early on, we actually, I'm a big believer in finding people who are really good at what they do. And to help us, you know, think about hiring and HR, we actually brought in a guy from Chicago.
Oh, really?
Right? And he told us this, hire slowly, and he helped us develop techniques for finding motivated, passionate, committed people, not looking at experience and resumes and education, but looking at the person themselves. And then he said, and if it's not a fit and you made a mistake, Jim, fire
just
quickly.
Go, yeah.
And I thought, that's really harsh. But the guy who taught us this was a priest. He had started his career as a priest. You know, his last name was Ryan. He was Father Ryan until he started a human relations business. And he said, no, that's a kindness.
A smart priest, a kindness. That
yes, because if, you know, when we hire people, we hire really wonderful people. But if there's not a fit, we're not doing them a favor keeping them in a situation where they're not going to succeed, because they'll go somewhere else and be successful.
That's Jim Cook, the founder of Sam Adams Beer, and now the author, Quench Your Own Thirst, Business Lessons Learned Over a Beer or Two. It was great to meet you. Thank you very much for coming
in. It was fun writing the book. And one kind of very unconventional, surprising thing is that all the profits from Quench Your Own Thirst go to our Brewing the American Dream program, which makes small business loans to up-and-coming businesses in food, beverage, and hospitality. We've made over 60 of them here in Chicagoland, including, and this is the counterintuitive part, loans to small breweries to help them get off the ground the way I did.
We're out of time. I wanted to ask you about that, but that's the fact that you invest in what will be or could be your competition, because the tide lifts all boats.
Well, we're creating a revolution, you know, and if the revolution succeeds, we all win. That's how Sam Adams did it.
Jim Cook, thanks very much. Nice to see you. You're listening to the
Cheers
Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's 12:38, and you're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Scott Kleinberg is here. He writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. For a few more days. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the penultimate visit, right?
Yes, it is.
Scott has taken a job to become the social media director for Mayor de Blasio in New York City. So I'm very excited for him, but we will miss him.
Thank you.
Okay, and so we'll do all the hugging and stuff Friday. Let's get down to it. Google has applied for a patent.
Yep.
That will be able to read my facial expressions?
Yes, basically.
So if I'm holding a phone, looking at having a Google search, then they will what? Figure out whether I'm happy with the search?
Yep. Based on your reaction, your pupils, based on body temperature, based on whether or not you're sweating, it's absolutely amazing and creepy at the same time.
I think it's mostly creepy,
Where your camera will be able to sense using, you know, how you're actually feeling.
When does it become not your camera?
Well, that's a whole separate thing.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe sooner than we think.
But
okay, so the idea is that what I think they're saying is, and they've applied for a patent for this, which means the technology must be, it must exist,
it
right?
means, well, that usually means it's in development. Right, so that doesn't mean that it's happening around the corner, but it certainly means that they can do it. And basically, if you think of it as everything you do now online, you give a rating, you give a 5-star rating or a 4-star rating this way, and it would certainly be an opt-in kind of thing because it's a privacy issue, but it would basically render that obsolete. It would basically say, you search for this, and rather than saying, take a short survey and tell us how we did or rate it 1 to 5, it'll say, well, it looks like you were very unhappy with how this search went based on your eye movement or based on your
Twitch. No, really, Twitch, it's okay. Yeah. I just have a Twitch. I have a Twitch. All right, so we'll see if that comes down the road.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I'm not sure I'm altogether in favor of that one. There was a study. Apple was talking about security and how many times we unlock or look at our phone every day.
Yep, how many times we unlock it a day.
Yeah. And what's the average?
80 times a day.
Yeah, I think that's got to be low for you.
Oh, absolutely.
Me too.
Oh, my gosh. I was reading that. I was like, oh, it's got to be 200 times.
So 80 times a day, that would be what, every 15 minutes or so, right? 4 times an hour?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
All right, 4 times an hour, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be 60. Yeah.
And we're both in journalism.
That is not
right?
something I know anything about.
right, but their idea was they were talking about security and all of that,
yep.
And then, so that's how many times we tend to look.
Yep.
I think I'm probably there by the time I get to noon. I'm sure I've probably looked at my phone 80 times already today,
right,
and
right.
unlocked it to do it. Right. But what's their point there? Why were they telling us that?
I think it's because, you know, people are using their fingerprints to unlock devices. You know, it's this whole encryption debate that's going on about, you know, FBI and Apple and all that stuff. And just to think about, you know, using a fingerprint for Touch ID or using a password, how many times we're actually unlocking it, it's important to know that we're actually enabling these features. We're enabling the Touch ID to make sure we can use our fingerprint. We're making sure we use passwords. The thing that's so fascinating on the iPhone is you can use either a fingerprint, which is obviously strong, mm-hmm. or you can use a 4-digit code, which is a default that everybody uses, and most people pick something like 1234, or maybe their bank ATM, which they shouldn't do. There's an option to do a 6-digit numerical and alphanumeric code, but it's hidden in the settings, and no one ever uses it. And there's talk about making that an actual default thing in the future, but right now it's basically saying if we are unlocking our phones that many times a day, we have to make sure our phones are safe while we're doing
right,
it.
Right, and so if we only use the numbers after we've powered down the phone, right, or sometimes to buy something?
Well, no. The number is actually, it depends how you have it set.
I have a thumbprint, so I can use my thumbprint anytime.
You can use your thumbprint, or you can use your code. So when I unlock my phone 200 times a day or whatever it is, it depends on how I'm holding it. If I'm holding it in my left hand, really? Which I use the thumbprint, I do that. Otherwise, I type in the number. So it can be either.
All right, let's get this.
Yep.
You also write that Apple made $43.6 million in retrieved gold last year.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to say that again. Apple made $43.6 million in retrieved gold.
Yep.
From
cell phones, because they recycled the devices, and the devices contain gold, and there was 2,204 pounds of gold in these recycled devices.
So I've got gold in my iPhone.
You have gold in your iPhone. They use gold in the filaments. They use gold in places for conductivity. I mean, gold is a good conduit. So, yeah, they use gold. And
wow.
With gold being whatever it is, $1,289 an ounce or something like that, it adds up quickly.
Interesting that it's still, and with the value of it, it's worth them to extract that gold to pay for the extraction. And the beauty of it is they've retrieved it. They can use it now in other phones, so
that's
it
exactly
reduces
right.
the mining of it all.
That's exactly right. Each phone apparently contains about 25 milligrams of gold, which I didn't know until I read. I thought that was pretty interesting.
That is, I had no idea.
Yep.
One more thing I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
You know, I'm on LinkedIn. Someone told me once I had to be on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn's important to be on, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not active on it now, so I have like 500 connection requests.
That's usually how LinkedIn goes.
Yeah,
everybody wants to be a friend with
right,
you.
Right,
yeah.
And so I just kind of let it go. But anyway, so it's good for students who want to find jobs and get connections, right?
Yes.
And LinkedIn is now sort of focusing an area of their site for that. Explain that for me.
An area of their site and a separate app that they're calling LinkedIn Students. They're doing the Facebook thing where you they think you need a separate app in a family to create the perfect experience. So they have this app or this new app called LinkedIn Students, which is super, super easy to use. And it's basically tips and tricks from employers. How can you best interact with people that you know, with potential employers, with professors at school? I think it's really creative for people who are getting their first job or coming out of school to get them to use the platform and realize how important it will be later when they actually get their first job. Scott, from that perspective, it makes sense.
Scott Kleinberg, good to see you again. Thanks very much for coming in.
Great to see you, Steve.
And we'll see you on Friday afternoon. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720. Oh, we're going to talk cannabis a little bit later on The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Legalize it. Don't criticize it. It's almost legalized. At least it is in some parts of the world. It's 420. So let's talk a little bit about marijuana. And, well, Kurt Akers is in the studio, co-founder and CEO of Canatopia. You guys are coming above ground, aren't you?
Yeah, we're getting close here.
Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate
it. Bring that microphone a little close to you. But so Canatopia is Facebook for cannabis users?
Facebook, Twitter, kind of Foursquare is what it's kind of being dubbed as right
now. Explain it for me.
So basically, Canatopia is a social network for modern cannabis consumers, connecting them with like-minded individuals like themselves, whether they're somebody who may be more comfortable using a username or somebody who wants to use their real identity, it's up to them, kind of their choice. And then for cannabis businesses and brands, they have a place and a platform where they can go and not be afraid to have their business pages shut down like they currently do on Facebook and Twitter.
And why are they shut down?
A variety of reasons. Those main social media companies have taken just a standoff approach, and most people, like a dispensary or cultivator, get their accounts shut down, just get a notification saying, hey, your account's been violating our terms of service policy.
And so as we sit here and talk about this, it sounds a little bit like they might be collecting members like, who watched James Franco and Seth Rogen movies, right? But that's not really what it's about.
No, it's not. So there's a huge medical aspect to it. Illinois is a medical marijuana state right now. And these people are really looking for an environment where they can talk about their cannabis experiences. But they don't have, they're not as comfortable doing it on such a wide network like a Facebook or Twitter because it's, still a taboo nature space, or they don't want to connect it to family members or employers.
And so the idea is that they can share recipes, share fears, share encouragement?
Yeah, so they can kind of talk about their stuff from a social community aspect. And then we've developed specific features around guides, around recommendation, and around managing your cannabis experiences. So users can create different types of strain guides or smell guides or how-to or recipe guides. And then they're also able to manage their cannabis experiences by saying, hey, this is the strain I want to use. This is the feeling it's kind of giving me. And kind of this is the dosage I have. So it's almost like your personal diary.
Well, what percentage of the users do you envision will be, and when I say users, I mean what Canatopia users,
yeah,
will be medical, and what percentage recreational?
It's hard to say at this moment. We're still about to launch the beta version. We have an entire spectrum so far from the users we've collected.
You're attracted to this not by your habit, but by your family.
Yeah. So my brother's actually an epileptic who uses medical cannabis on a daily basis. He was attending Indiana University and got jumped up Madison, Wisconsin, and started having epilepsy not too far after it. So he uses medical cannabis to combat a lot of side effects he gets from his pharmaceutical medications.
How does it work for him, Kurt?
For him, it's really helpful on the side effects side. So he takes about 20 pills a day just to try and combat this epilepsy. So he has, loss of appetite, lots of nausea, what we call dizzy spells that happen quite frequently. So the medical cannabis for him really helps by combating a lot of that stuff due to a lot of the CBD properties of the cannabis.
So I'm imagining he gets medical marijuana legally?
Yes. He actually lives in Seattle, Washington now.
Okay, so then he's getting guidance from his doctor or things like that, but there might be things that he wants to talk about, maybe not with his doctor, or that other questions, and that's where they would get this information at Canatopia.
Right. So they'd be able to go to Canatopia, maybe talk to different types of people who've gone through these experiences. They'd be able also to look at the kind of guides that users have created or user generated to understand how one strain may be affecting them and what they want to use for their own personal.
Okay, so it's you're dealing with a product that is legal in some areas and not in others, and then sort of legal in some areas and not in others.
Right.
How do you maneuver all of that when it comes to marketing and selling, advertising, and figuring all of that out? Because it must be a minefield.
Yeah, so we try to identify the states that are most understandable for marijuana state laws. For us, you know, there's 23 medical marijuana states and 4 recreational states, 24 now with Pennsylvania, actually. So we'll be operating in those states first, and as more states come on, then we'll kind of move into those markets.
Well, what do you mean operating in those states? Because, I mean, I can log onto a website from any state, right?
Correct. So, but for the application, you know, Apple Store only allows, there's different requirements for the applications themselves.
Okay.
So for those apps, those will probably only be available in the 23 medical marijuana states.
So you're not up and running yet?
Nope, not yet.
When do you expect to be up and running?
We're kind of on day-to-day operations.
You might find out when you go back to 1871 you're up and running?
You never know. Yeah. We're pretty close. We're just finishing up some stuff that we noticed in our alpha testing, and you know,
exciting.
We are excited to get it out there finally.
Are you more nervously excited or giddy excited?
Giddy excited.
Are you? Good for you.
We've got some good feedback around people from 1871, a lot of our, you know, friends and family around the space. And they're definitely looking for this type of environment because, you know, our focus is, you know, focusing on modern cannabis consumers. So, you know, it's a very different topic compared to, say, the stoner demographic of people. We want to actually show that this is a legitimate industry. This is a legitimate product used by mainstream people that also need a place to go to and talk about their experiences.
That's Kurt Akers, the co-founder and CEO of Canatopia, coming to a computer or app near you sometime soon. Thanks. It was nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.